Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine, who examines what he believes are the strategic political calculations behind the White House drive to launch a new U.S. war against Iraq. Robert Weissman of the Mobilization for Global Justice, who explains why tens of thousands of activists will once again be protesting against the policies of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C. the last week of September. And Nancy Alderman, President of Environment and Human Health, who discusses a study conducted by her group which found that children riding school buses are exposed to dangerous levels of cancer-causing diesel fuel exhaust. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
At the start of this year's welfare reform debate, children's advocates were hopeful about taking some of the sharp edges off the 1996 reform law that expires on October 1st. Hawaii Congresswoman Patsy Mink introduced a bill that would cut back time limits on public assistance benefits, now called Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, or TANF. According to the news magazine In These Times, the bill called for a major hike in child care spending over the next 5 years and more dollars for education and training of welfare mothers. Yet the bill never made it to the floor of the House of Representatives. Instead, President Bush stole the show on welfare in late February when he called for 70% of people on welfare to work 40 hours a week. Mark Greenberg of the Center for Law and Social Policy remarked, "Almost overnight, the discussion shifted to who can be tougher in imposing welfare requirements on families receiving welfare." The Bush agenda remains largely intact in the bill under consideration in the U.S. Senate. The only open question is how much new money will go to child care. The Republican House of Representatives added $2 billion over the next 5 years, while the current Senate bill boosts child care by $5 billion. Meanwhile, advocates like the Children's Defense Fund are pushing for an increase of $11.25 billion for child care. But while this debate proceeds, states are slashing child care programs due to growing budget deficits. Among the recent corporate scandals, ConAgra's huge recall of ground beef stands out as one of the most dangerous to public health. In July, the big meat packer recalled 19 million pounds of ground beef from its Greenlee, Colorado plant because it was contaminated with a strain of E. coli bacteria. In mid-June, inspectors from the U.S. Department of Agriculture detected E. coli in ConAgra beef, but failed to tell the company for 2 weeks. Meanwhile, the tainted ground beef was sold at supermarkets, restaurants, and cooked at outdoor barbecues. A supermarket chain in Colorado actually advertised a two-for-one special of the dangerous meat. In early July, ConAgra started a voluntary recall of the tainted meat that was later expanded to cover all the ground beef processed at the Greenlee plant from mid-April to mid-July. According to The Nation magazine, one person died from the meat and nearly 50 were reported sick. Still, only one-tenth of the meat was returned, with the rest apparently eaten by consumers. At the moment, the USDA has only limited powers to test meat for E. coli contamination. Critics say the testing regime is very weak and company employees oftentimes actually do the meat inspections themselves. Food safety has taken a back seat in the Bush administration, which collected $600,000 in campaign contributions from beef producers. The White House also appointed a former chief lobbyist from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association as a top aide to Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman. In the spring of 2001, local TV news was filled with stories about a new epidemic on the horizon. The ailment was called Generalized Anxiety Disorder, or GAD, that had symptoms like fatigue, muscle tension, and nausea, resulting, we were told, in feeling helpless in coping with irrational fears. According to Mother Jones magazine, the media blitz was no accident. On April 21, 2001, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the use of Paxil, an antidepressant made by GlaxoSmithKline, for treatment of GAD. Before the massive media campaign, GAD was a little-known condition impacting only 1.2% of Americans. So to boost sales of Paxil, GlaxoSmithKline orchestrated media coverage to sell the disease and raise awareness before it put its drug on the market. Over the last decade, drug companies have pushed hard to expand sales of antidepressants like Paxil, Prozac, Celexa, and Zoloft. Since 1990, the sales of these antidepressants have increased eightfold. In recent years, the big drug firms have been looking for new uses for antidepressants. Eli Lilly has proposed using Prozac, which is now sold in generic form, as an alternative to estrogen for treatment of hot flashes and premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Some, like Brown University psychologist Paula Kaplan, objected to linking menstrual cycles to mental health, and she resigned from the medical panel that worked to define the new condition. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
The White House campaign to garner public support for a new war against Iraq, launched during the summer, quickly overshadowed most other domestic and foreign policy issues facing the U.S. The call for war has effectively pushed coverage of the sputtering economy and corporate crime scandals off the front pages of newspapers and to the margins of TV news shows. Statements made earlier this year by White House political director Karl Rove indicate that the Bush administration's demand for war is very much connected to this November's important midterm congressional election, where control of the closely divided House and Senate are at stake. The White House is now working hard to secure both UN and congressional resolutions authorizing the automatic use of force if Iraq fails to fully cooperate with international weapons inspectors. But Baghdad's recent offer to allow inspectors back into Iraq without precondition has slowed down the march to war. The election victory of the Social Democratic Green Party coalition in Germany, a battle largely fought over U.S.-Iraq war plans, has also complicated the president's hope for wider international support. By and large, Democratic Party leaders have supported the Bush plan to invade Iraq. But former Vice President and White House candidate Al Gore surprised many when, in a September 23rd speech, he criticized the Bush-Iraq policy for weakening the U.S. fight against terrorism and undermining international law. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine, who examines what he believes are the strategic political calculations behind the White House drive to launch a new U.S. war against Iraq.
Rest assured, all signals point to the current pressure for a war with Iraq being driven entirely by the election schedule. The Bush administration has looked very seriously at its realities. They are one seat away from control of the U.S. Senate. Where most of the Senate races are in play this year is in states which might be vulnerable to a sort of last-minute patriotic appeal. South Dakota, Arkansas, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, South Carolina, North Carolina. They signaled early on that they were going to try and make the fall campaign be about national security issues. And in August, they started to rather ineptly ramp up a threat from Iraq, a supposed threat. Now, as we're barely 40 days away from the election, it's all anybody's talking about. They've succeeded quite brilliantly.
Certainly they didn't succeed in a vacuum. How have they been allowed to steal the agenda without much in the way of documentary proof of a new and imminent threat from Iraq?
Well, let's be clear. There's no proof whatsoever of a new threat. In fact, both John Murtha and David Obey, the two savviest members of the House on intelligence issues, the third being Porter Goss from Florida, but Murtha and Obey have both said in the last few days that they have read all intelligence reports regarding Iraq for the last several years, every one that's come through, and they have access to them, and there has been no change in the CIA, State Department, Defense Department analysis of threats posed by Iraq. There is no new threat. Does not exist. So Once we accept that reality, that this is a completely manufactured moment, then we ask, well, how do they succeed? Well, the fact of the matter is that our media in this country no longer covers the Defense Department or war whatsoever. We have no sort of independent analysis of what it's doing, by and large. Certainly, mainstream media doesn't exist. And secondly, our media no longer covers politics. They may create the facade of political coverage with reports on a candidate appearing someplace or a political party having a convention. But the serious coverage of what's really going on in political campaigns and in political maneuvering has been seeded by network television and by virtually all major daily newspapers, with the possible exception of the New York Times and the Washington Post. But even they have become stunningly casual about coverage of what's really going on.
It seems that the Democratic Party has really been silent or acquiesced totally to the Bush administration agenda here, thinking that their best shot at electoral advantage is to keep their mouth shut.
That's exactly right. The Democratic Party has played this issue just as cynically as the Bush administration has. They want the fall election to be about economic issues. The Bush administration wants the fall election to be about national security. Each party is maneuvering and playing games. The Democrats initially thought that their best strategy was to try and neglect the issue altogether. That didn't work. The Bush people kept pushing it again and again and again, coming at every angle, finally using the UN gambit, which worked. And now the Democrats are forced into a situation in Congress where they know they're going to face a vote. And the response of leadership has essentially been to work with the Bush administration to try and nurture up a resolution that can get virtually unanimous support. Bush administration's obviously arguing for strong language, Democratic leadership in Congress arguing for somewhat muted language. End result is, whatever the final language of any resolution that comes through, it will be read by the Bush administration as a go-ahead to launch a war whenever they choose. And the disturbing fact is that even now, all appearances suggest that Tom Daschle, the Senate Democratic leader, is playing this entirely as a political issue, looking for how best to get out from under the issue to make it go away as quickly as possible. Gephardt in the House doing much the same thing. What that means is we're likely to have votes very rapidly on Iraq because Gephardt and Daschle just want it to go away. And they're willing to cede the constitutionally mandated congressional authority over the declaration of war, as well as their constitutionally mandated advice and consent responsibilities, in order to get in position for an election. It's a very disturbing phenomenon, and one that honest players ought to be furious with. They should be angry with the Bush administration for playing this as purely a political issue. They should be equally angry with the Democratic Party for failing to challenge.
That was John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine. Read his articles in the pages of The Nation or online at www.thenation.com. Last September, social justice activists were in the midst of organizing large demonstrations against the policies of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., when the September 11th terrorist attacks necessitated cancellation of their actions. 1 year later, tens of thousands of protesters are once again planning to converge on the nation's capital to make demands on these U.S.-controlled financial institutions. Through teach-ins, street theater, rallies, and direct action, students, labor activists, environmentalists, and human rights advocates will demand that the World Bank and IMF open their meetings to public scrutiny, cancel the corrosive debt owed by impoverished nations, end policies which deny people access to essential resources, services, and human rights, and stop support for environmentally destructive projects. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Weissman, editor of the multinational Monitor magazine, currently working with the Mobilization for Global Justice. He summarizes the demands of demonstrators gathering in Washington the last week of September and the connection between the neoliberal policies of the World Bank and IMF and recent U.S. corporate scandals.
Well, the core message is that the IMF and the World Bank are inflicting needless suffering on millions of people around the world as they impose market fundamentalist policies on them, as they demand that poor people pay to go to clinics, as they try to privatize water systems, and as they impose austerity measures on countries that are very poor. So we're trying to call attention to those policies and push to limit the power of the institutions to continue to do the harm that they have done over the last 20 or more years.
Over the last 3 or more years, the World Bank and the IMF have been the target of militant protests around the world. I wondered if you would really talk about maybe the most concrete and important disagreements between critics in the World Bank IMF policies.
Well, from the Mobilization for Global Justice, we've put forward 4 demands of the institutions that we think crystallize the calls that have come from developing countries where protests against the institutions are much more frequent and much larger scale than even they've been in the United States in the last few years. Those demands involve canceling the debt that is owed to the institutions by the poorest countries. And we emphasize the importance of using the institutions' existing resources because they have enough money to cancel the debt right now without any further money coming in from the United States or other rich country taxpayers. That's one. A second is to end their policies that deprive people of the right to food, clean water, housing, education, the right to organize, the set of policies that are often known as structural adjustment. The third demand has been to end World Bank support for environmentally and socially destructive projects like oil mining and gas, large dams, or logging projects. And finally, we've called on the institutions to open their meetings, to become much more transparent, to let people see what goes on behind their closed doors, people in the United States where our taxpayer money is being used to do harm, but especially people in the developing countries who bear the brunt of what the IMF and the World Bank do.
Robert, in the past year, we've seen major scandals, major corporate scandals here in the United States, Enron, Global Crossing, WorldCom. How has that affected your work in ringing the alarm for some of the policies of deregulation and privatization, which many believe are at the root cause of corporate malfeasance here in the United States? And what is the connection, if any, to the World Bank and IMF and their policies?
Well, those are exactly some of the key issues. I think deregulation, privatization, marketization of almost everything, those were the phenomena that were at the core of the rise and fall of Enron and WorldCom and the rest. And they also happen to be many of the core policies of the IMF and the World Bank. So they almost always support deregulation of markets, the marketization of activities and services that weren't formally part of the market, and privatization without any nuance or regard to particular consequences. So just to take a couple examples, the healthcare user fee example is one in terms of marketization where in many cases people might have had a right to just attend clinics for free if they had pressing needs, at least in terms of getting primary care. And the bank has imposed the marketization model saying, look, let's charge people for that instead. In terms of deregulation, you see it throughout all sectors of the economy, thanks to the IMF and the bank, from the financial sphere to areas like natural resource extraction. So if you look at countries like the Philippines, where they've deregulated the mining sector, there's been a huge infusion of foreign capital, with a lot of big mining companies coming in, displacing small miners, pushing aside tens of thousands of residents off their land, despoiling the land, and then not paying very much even by way of taxes, let alone royalties, to the government. In terms of privatization, we've seen a huge push by both the IMF and the bank for privatization of all kinds of enterprises. In fact, Enron was one of the beneficiaries of the bank's privatization push. In the Dominican Republic, the bank loaned $20 million to the Dominican Republic to facilitate the privatization of its electric utility. The Dominican Republic sold off the utility in parts to a number of different companies, including Enron. Enron then jacked up the rates so high that consumers couldn't pay. The government took on the obligation to pay for consumers because no one could afford to keep their lights on. Eventually, the government wasn't able to pay the rates that Enron was demanding, and Enron imposed blackouts on the country because now they have control over one of the fundamental services in the Dominican Republic. Now it has occurred that there's a controversy emerging over how much Enron paid for the electric utility as well as the other companies that bought up the electric utility. The issue is perhaps they paid too little. Maybe the company that did the valuation of the electric utility really said it wasn't worth as much as it was. They undervalued it. The company that did the valuation was none other than Arthur Andersen.
That was Robert Weissman, editor of the multinational Monitor magazine and an organizer with the Mobilization for Global Justice. Contact the Mobilization office at area code 202-276-4207 or visit their website at www.globalizethis.org. In early September, the Environmental Protection Agency declared that long-term exposure to diesel exhaust can cause cancer. Rules passed under the Clinton administration requiring trucks to use low-sulfur fuel are due to go into effect in 2006, but that ruling does not affect buses. Last year, before the EPA decision was announced, a public health advocacy group in Connecticut studied the impact of diesel exhaust on school children who ride diesel-fueled buses. 15 adults wearing badges or other measurement devices accompanied 15 school children throughout the day to get accurate readings on their exposure. They found that children were sometimes exposed to airborne particulates 5 to 15 times higher than background levels. Nearly 600,000 school buses transport 24 million students to school every day in the U.S. Collectively, American children spend 3 billion hours on school buses each year. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nancy Alderman, president of Environment and Human Health, the group that conducted the study. Its report, issued in February of this year, made several recommendations for minimizing the risk children take when boarding a school bus.
We decided to look into it because we realized that buses, that their emissions were not regulated at all, that they were not tested. We also realized that school buses were using diesel when prior to the 1980s they had always been powered by gasoline, and that diesel exhaust was a problem for children's health, especially for their airways, and with 1 out of 11 school children in Connecticut having asthma, we thought we really needed to take a look at school buses. We decided the most accurate way to look at what was really going on was to look at individual children and monitor them. So what we did is we got permission from 15 school children to simply follow them during their school day. We had no idea what their buses were like or anything. We got permission from the children and then met them at early morning around 7 o'clock, and whatever bus picked them up, we got on with the children, and we followed them through the school day until the bus let them off at the end of the day, and that was how we did it.
What did you find?
What we found were a bunch of different things. We found, for instance, that idling buses was a very serious problem. And in this state, and I'm sure it's probably true across the country, when buses were picking up children at schools, they were nose to tail, idling for very long periods of time while the children filled into the buses. And those buses were filling substantially with diesel exhaust. So one of the most important things, and we thought the easiest thing, and no cost to the state, and probably a savings because of the fuel, was to get a no-idling law right away. And we did get that in this legislating season. In 2002, the Connecticut legislature passed a no-idling bill. And so as we go around town, sometimes buses would drop children off at a museum, and we would see those buses idle the entire time the children were in the museum. We don't see that now. The bus companies are taking this very seriously. So I can't recommend that enough for across the country. What an easy way to reduce children's exposures. I have talked with the executive director of the School Bus Professional Association called CASA, and I know from them that they are all taking it very seriously.
So what are some of the impacts of this kind of exposure to children, specifically with diesel exhaust and soot and the kind of things that they apparently were inhaling while they were riding the buses.
Diesel exhaust is a very serious toxic. California has it listed on their list of carcinogens, number 6 on the list. So, number 1, we know a number of things. We know that diesel exhaust exacerbates asthma and asthma attacks. We know that it causes inflammation of the airways. We know now that it is a carcinogen. It is made up of particulates which go into the lungs, which have on them items such as compounds such as formaldehyde, benzene, 1,3-butadiene, soot. All of these are known carcinogens, and when they adhere to these small particles and get delivered deep into the lungs, they then become delivery systems to the rest of your body. So this diesel exhaust is not a good thing. The question is, what can we do about it? What can we do about it in the short term? What can we do about it in the long term? In the short term, the most important and easiest things to do immediately, one is, of course, to get no idling legislation through every state. Number 2, we need to move these buses into low-sulfur fuel, low-sulfur diesel fuel immediately. The EPA is going to mandate, if it's not rolled back by the present administration, is going to mandate in the year 2006 that all diesel fuel be low-sulfur in order to reduce the emissions. But we've got to get our school buses over as soon as possible to protect these children. We don't have to do anything to the school buses to do that. You just change the fuel. Then when that gets done, as we move down to better and they are more expensive solutions, it then, once you have moved to low sulfur fuel, you can then retrofit the buses with particle traps and catalytic converters. You cannot do that on the high sulfur fuel that they're now using. As well, we really should be testing our school buses. We test our cars. The school buses were exempt. That stuff just comes out of the tailpipe. I mean, there's nothing between that fuel and what's coming out of the tailpipe.
That was Nancy Alderman of Environment and Human Health. Visit the group's website at www.ehhi.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Zelfia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.